Hey everyone, Parsa here, and I am super excited about today's episode because our guest today is Kevin Tucker, Chief Curator at the High Museum of Art right here in Atlanta, Georgia. Now, I was very excited to speak with Kevin in his office because we are, at this point of recording, about a little less than a week out from the opening of the Phillips Collection coming to the High Museum for the next few months. Now, Kevin, before joining the High Museum in June of 2017, was the founding director of the Museum of the American Arts and Crafts Movement in St. Petersburg, Florida, where he helped develop plans for a 137,000 square foot facility for their collection of early 20th century craft, photography, paintings, and other works. Prior to that, he was the Margot B. Perot Senior Curator of Decorative Arts and Design at the Dallas Museum of Art. During his time there, he helped develop the museum's program of modern and contemporary design, on which he has also written extensively. Prior to that, he was the chief curator and deputy director at the Columbia Museum of Art. And prior to that, he was the curator of decorative arts and Owens Thomas House at the Telfair Museum of Art in Savannah, Georgia. Needless to say, Kevin's professional history and accolades are numerous and highly impressive. And for that, I was really honored to be able to get the opportunity to pick his brain sitting down in his office the other day. Kevin, thanks so much for giving us the opportunity. We sat down with Kevin to talk about what the role of a curator really is from the basic definition of what a curator for an arts museum does, as well as kind of the role of a curator in today's art world and how the curatorial arts are shifting somewhat and adapting to accommodate for kind of the new shift in how people consume information, consume art, and interact physically with art museums and galleries and things like that. Now, Kevin has just come off the successful reinstallation of the High Museum's permanent collection in 2018, for which he was just beginning when he came on as chief curator in June of 2017. Most people, I understand, are lucky to have one or two reinstallations in their whole career as a curator. Kevin, as he would say it, has just come off his third and a half, so to speak. But congratulations to Kevin, no small feat there. On top of talking about what it means to be a curator and the day in the life of a curator, we also talk about what Kevin's role is specifically at the High Museum in terms of managing his team of curators, in terms of contributing to what the High is doing with regards to helping visitors and the community better interact with artwork through various mechanisms like First Friday and Second Sunday and things like that, on top of many other initiatives that the High is doing with not only their collection and their gallery, but also just other interactive events to get the community involved. We talk about what it took to really set up and successfully run the Yayoi Kusama Infinity Mirrors exhibit that was so popular over the last few months here in Atlanta, Georgia, how Kevin and his team, the entire team at the High Museum, was able to leverage information from the Kusama team as well as other museums that had hosted the show beforehand to really create a superb experience for everybody who was able to go to that exhibit here in Atlanta. We also talk about Kevin's heart for the South, being from South Carolina, and working a lot throughout the Southern United States. Kevin brings a lot of passion for Southern art to his role as chief curator. The High Museum now has over 17,000 works in the museum from 19th and 20th century American and decorative art, European paintings, African American art, modern and contemporary photography, folk and self-taught art, and African art. Kevin, thank you so much for taking the time. I am sure all of the listeners, you are going to really, really enjoy this interview. And then after this kind of long-winded intro, well-deserved, but long-winded intro, I present today's interview with Chief Curator of the High Museum, Mr. Kevin Tucker.
Any given moment, we know what the world is feeling.
Are you wearing pajama pants to school? Why, yes, I am. I was, in a way, elevating him. I was celebrating him.
We wanted to build a beer pong table.
No, it's the Show ATL podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Show ATL podcast. I am your host, Parsa, and today we are sitting with the man himself, Kevin Tucker, Chief Curator at the High Museum of Art. Kevin, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me on the show.
We're sitting here in your office, which has a great view of Symphony Hall. And by great view, I mean we can see the back of it,
yes,
which is nice, but you're in the Bunzel Administration Building right next to the High, so you've got about as front row seat to your work and to all of the works at the High as you can get.
Absolutely. They like keeping us close to the art, which is a great thing, so that's where we prefer to be.
I imagine, and I wonder, how often do you leave the confines of this building and this office on a day-to-day basis to make your way through the museum, or does it vary based on seasonality and what exhibit is going up?
Well, it's an everyday occurrence. We have this entire campus complex. So the Bunzel Administration Building, where majority of our offices are located, just one component of that campus. And all of the buildings that are part of the campus are woven together through connectors, physical connectors, and then the piazza, which is the public gathering space in front of the museum. So where I go in terms of meetings with the colleagues, where I go to walk into the galleries to see how work is going in those spaces or in workspaces in other buildings, it's pretty much an everyday occurrence for me. Certainly there's some days where I spend much more time sitting at my desk looking at a computer.
Yep.
Then there are really those wonderful moments where I get to engage with my colleagues, I get to talk about what we're doing, I get to, of course, have those special moments in the galleries with the works of art, seeing how the public interacts and enjoys those works of art. And then, of course, the downtimes when the galleries are not open to the public. And I actually get one of the great perks of the job is getting able to spend individual time with those works with no one else around. And certainly that's a very special moment, too, to be able to enjoy those few minutes in doing that.
Yeah. I mean, I imagine there's a lot of variety in the scenery on a day-to-day basis for someone in your profession. You are the chief curator of the High Museum, and we're going to get into your background here in a minute. You are highly qualified for the job, to say the least. But as chief curator, what does the job entail? And I kind of do want to get into a little bit of like a day in the life of Kevin Tucker, but I feel like for a good portion of the people who are listening to the show, they may not know exactly what a curator of a art institution like the High Museum actually does.
Yes.
So if you would just...
Absolutely.
What do you do?
Absolutely. You know, no. I'm often asked, you know, well, what is a curator? Just sort of the basic question of, you know, what is the significance of that? And, you know, you can get into the etymology of the word curator. What does it really mean? And ultimately goes back to a root word, to care for. And we care for art collections in the case of an art museum. And there are curators of history museums, curators of science museum that have their own responsibilities. And that to care for, that notion, care for, means that you're not only caring for objects, physical objects, but you're also caring for the intellectual realm around those objects, research, and how the objects are interpreted and presented, et cetera. So when people say, you know, what is a curator? And I say, well, let's back up. A curator is a subcategory of an educator. I'm an educator. I'm a teacher. And I come from a long line of teachers in my family. And when someone asks me, and they look at me strange when I say I'm a curator, then I say, well, I'm essentially a teacher. I do my teaching through objects, in this case, through art objects. That has long been sort of a passion and an interest of mine. It's sort of elemental to understanding what we do. As a chief curator, I'm doing something a little bit different. Rather than working with a specific collection. The High Museum of Art has a number of departments, and each of those departments has one or more curators responsible for those collections and the exhibitions and the programs related to those projects. And so, you know, we have a photography department, we have a department of African art, we have a department of American art, we have a department of European art, we have, you know, modern and contemporary, folk and self-taught, decorative arts and design. So the various departments within the museum, each curator within that department has their specialization. And I have the pleasure of working with all of my colleagues across those departments to help strategize what the High is doing in sort of the larger curatorial sense. What exhibitions are we developing? What collections are we pursuing? What exhibition catalogs and related publications are colleagues developing for these projects? And so I work very closely with our curatorial team here, and then our other colleagues in the museum as well, whether it's the administration wing and the director's office, or whether it's logistics and collections and exhibitions. So everything that the curators do is really around the notion of generating content for the museum.
Okay.
So that content is most apparent in the exhibitions that we do and that our visitors enjoy.
Right. And it seems as though your role is part educator and executive and part manager.
It absolutely is. And that's sort of the transition. I've been a chief curator before, many years ago, but most recently had for the last dozen or so years had returned to my expertise in architecture and design. I was a decorative arts and design curator with the Dallas Museum of Art for over 12 years. And that's really had been my background, my training, my interest. And so I developed exhibitions around the decorative and design arts and various projects. But I also realized that one of my real great passions was being an advocate for the curatorial profession and for the work of so many of my colleagues. And I realized that in many ways, I was more expert in working around those concepts and working around those strategies for reinforcing the importance of the curatorial profession and being an advocate, truly being an advocate for my colleagues. So it was a logical step. It was a logical moment for me to return to that role in coming to Atlanta and, yes, being a manager and administrator and taking on that responsibility again. But it's one that I really enjoy. Yeah. So I still am very, you know, much immersed in the art world. I'm very much immersed in the sort of the day-to-day life of art here at the museum. And I like having that connection as well as the connection to my colleagues.
Yeah. Well, you can definitely see it in the quality of the work that's come out of the High Museum. The High Museum has always been this institution in Atlanta and the Southeast and the nation for being a huge beacon and advocate for the arts. And in the last 2 years now, almost 2 years exactly, of you taking on the chief curator role, the High has really taken on a much more kind of community-oriented focus in the way that it engages with the public and engages with the local community and engages with the Southeast arts community as a whole.
Absolutely. I certainly want to point to really the leadership that we've had under Rand Suffolk, our director, who has pointed the way for that new direction and laid the groundwork very clearly since his arrival over 3 years ago at this point, and taking the museum in a new direction in terms of engaging with the community, engaging with the notion of diversity across the board, and that's diversity for our exhibition program, for our education programs, stressing that in terms of our audience, stressing that in terms of staffing and our trustee pool. And so there has been a dramatic shift in that regard, and one that I think is really welcome, it's really timely, and it's very appropriate for the High in terms of engaging with the Atlanta community. A great art museum should reflect the passions and the interests of the community as well. And we do that, I think, in a really wonderful way. And we act as a conduit to the nation and to international art, and being able to put Atlanta and our collections in this broader context for everyone who comes through the door.
Right. And I do want to kind of get into your background a little bit because it is fairly impressive, and it brings me to a point that Rand Suffolk made when you were coming onto the team here at the High Museum June of 2017. But you got your Bachelor of Arts in History and Master of Arts from University of South Carolina. You spent time at the Owens Thomas House at the Telfair Museum in Savannah, Georgia. You were the chief curator and deputy director at the Columbia Museum of Art, senior curator of decorative arts and design for the Dallas Museum of Art, where you developed the museum's modern and contemporary design program, as well as the founding director of the Museum of American Arts and Crafts Movement. And from there, came onto the High Museum. Am I missing anything in that timeline? It's a fairly impressive timeline.
That's pretty comprehensive. And yes, that's what sort of sketched out my my focus has been, and on the Southeast in terms of, you know, connecting to various institutions, but institutions that each of them having decided national and international scope of collections and programs.
Right.
And that has always been a sort of near and dear to me as someone who was born in South Carolina, who's very much from the South, lived in the South. As much as there is that we should celebrate or scrutinize in terms of the South and its very complicated history and often challenging and difficult history, certainly within the visual arts, we want to find a way to celebrate the work, whether historic or contemporary. And again, there's that word context, bring it into that larger national and international context, because that's what makes it interesting, not to, to look at things in isolation, but to have a broader view. And that points very much to really my background and training as well. I think I came to the arts not by simply studying art history or studio, but more or less a multifaceted approach in terms of my background. And as an undergraduate, I studied history, I studied anthropology and archaeology. I did that as well in graduate school. And I was interested in the anthropological side of things in addition to the history and art history. So, because I wanted to, again, have the understanding of the broader context. And there was a book that I credit sort of for my path to becoming a curator, and it is appropriately enough a very small and thin book. It's called In Small Things Forgotten, and by James Dietz. And it was one of those introductory texts that you get in your early anthropology courses, but it was really about seemingly mundane objects, historic objects, 18th century clay pipes and headstones that one would find in cemeteries throughout the eastern United States, et cetera. And it charted the history of essentially design of these objects and what those small design cues meant in terms of, well, this was from England and this was from colonial states. This is from this influence or that influence and whatnot. And it really opened my eyes to how the visual arts inform critical analysis and thinking. And that was really the launching point for my study of architecture, for me taking studio coursework and learning, you know, if I'm going to talk about prints or printmaking, I need to actually try to make a print. If I'm going to talk about the history of furniture design, I actually need to learn how to cut joinery for furniture design. And I may do a terrible job at it initially, or some of the things I did better than others. But I think the hands-on experience became a very important part of my training and the multidisciplinary approach to studying cultural history, material history, art history, architectural history, so that I could look at an object and put it in that larger political, social, cultural, material context.
And I'm curious, are you a practitioner of art currently as well? I know that you mentioned that you play the ukulele, which is an art form.
Poorly.
All into itself.
Very but. Poorly. Well, and I think that's maybe that's a little bit of a love of in small instruments forgotten in this case, and just sort of the maligned instruments. I was once at a dinner party with some of the players from a particular symphony, and they were going around the table asking everyone. They said, "Oh, do you play a musical? Who plays a musical instrument?" "Oh, so and so." And I played the violin, and I played the flute, and so on. And they got to me, and I said, "Well, I've played the bagpipes, the penny whistle, and the ukulele." And one of the members of the dinner party leaned over and said, "Oh, I'm so sorry." Do I practice different arts now? Practice is the key word. So yes, occasionally, I'll play a musical instrument, and occasionally I'll do a little bit of painting or wood carving or something of this. But truly, in the amateur status, and one of the things working as a curator, you see the great accomplishments of great artists around the world, and you realize it truly does take a lifetime of commitment for so many of these artists to really create these amazing works of art. So it's, you become awed by the experience and humbled by it. And it's not to say that it's not achievable. And when people come to me and say, "Oh, I want to do this and I want to study and I want to be an artist," I was like, "Do it. Absolutely. Full encouragement." Because you don't know truly until you try and try and try and try again and again and again. I'm not a believer, and I quickly discourage it. I say, "Oh, I have no talent for that." I said, "Well, how often have you tried, and how much of a commitment have you given?" You know, I had no magical talent picking up a ukulele or picking up a brush and starting painting, and I wasn't expecting to be Picasso day one. But that's why, in part, why museums exist and schools exist and art programs exist, is to provide that framework so that you can build your experiences and then venture out on your own.
Yeah. Albert Einstein had a quote that genius is 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that was also applies to like Edison and others as well.
Sure. Yeah. Whoever actually quoted that to begin with is one of these things that's gotten kind of lost in the canon of American history, but applicable nonetheless as a quote, and maybe a bit cliche to pull out, but you have, on top of actually practicing various forms of art and your professional history that we've highlighted here in brief, you've written a lot about American decorative arts and metalware, and have over 5, 6, 7 major publications in the arts realm of varied topics and depth out there. And I'm sorry to say I haven't read all of them, but over a long career of working in various styles of art as both a curator, as an educator, and someone who is learning and is a scholar in the field and writing about various types of art and fields and timelines and et cetera, coming to the High Museum now with a passion for Southern art on top of everything else, right? But a passion for Southern art, the High Museum now has 16,000 plus works in its collection from 19th and 20th century American and decorative art, European paintings, African-American art, modern and contemporary photography, folk, self-taught, African art. It's a very kind of satiated and eclectic mix of artwork that you are now responsible for, granted in more of an executive managerial position. But from the perspective of what makes a good curator or a great curator, based on your really varied and comprehensive background, what are, in your opinion, some of the main traits of a truly great curator or chief curator for something as big as the High Museum?
Well, it may be cliche to say, but passion is an important part of it. You have to be, as a curator, you have to be passionate about whatever you're studying, your subject matter. Curators in the present day, there is really a shift away in terms of what makes a great curator. And there's a shift away from these older traditional models of a curator is essentially an academic who works with objects, period. full stop. And, you know, those sorts of curatorial positions are you know, going sort of the way of the dinosaur. And few curators can afford to these days simply say, I'm going to sit in the research library, I'm going to sit in front of my computer, I'm going to sit in front of a group of art objects, and I'm going to research them and catalog them and write about them, and I'm going to produce my publication, and then I'm done and I'm going to move on to the next one. That is not the reality for 99.9%, I think, of the present curatorial world. And so there's the passion for being able to delve into your research and be a scholar, be an expert in your field. Absolutely, that's still key in terms of a starting point. But a great curator now is layered in terms of how they communicate about the art that they're researching, and that they're not simply delivering this tome for with lots of, you know, really wonderful obscure references that all the specialists, all 10 of them, will want to read. You know, it's got to be an individual who wants to engage with the community, who wants to engage with the visitors, who really understands the educational mandate of the museum to reach all audiences. And that's one of the reasons I was so passionate about coming to the High, was seeing, well, we're not only serving all ages, which so many museums, of course, do, most museums, but that we have leadership that is fully engaged with embracing the diversity of the city. When you have a majority minority city, and before my arrival, statistically we had 15% people of color visiting the High Museum of Art, and now we're around 50%.
Wow.
So within the course of 3+ years, there has been a sea change, really. And, you know, why? And it's because programmatically we're engaging with exhibitions that address women, that address people of color. We're promoting what we have been doing. We've had sort of a transformative moment with reinstallation of the museum's collections and putting forward our best foot in what we've been collecting and focusing on. And I think, again, getting to back to the question, you know, what makes a great curator, I think it's someone who recognizes and can reflect upon and engage with the current world. And whether you're studying 18th century art or 21st century art, it doesn't really matter there. What matters is your sensitivity to the world that we live in and how people view that. And I think a lot of my colleagues who have dealt with historic art, they say, oh, well, the contemporary field is, you know, it's, you know, living artists, and they're, it's, you know, the hustle and the bustle and the frenzy around contemporary art. And I said, yeah, admittedly, you have a challenge of trying to find the angle where you, by which you make exciting, engaging, and relevant art that was produced 300 years ago or 400 years ago or however many hundred years ago, and bring it to a very different audience that might have experienced it those centuries ago. And it's certainly a challenge, but that's our job. I don't think it's impossible. I just think it's prompting a lot of museums and certainly a lot of curators to think differently.
Is there kind of a pivotal turning point or a moment in your career trajectory where you were able to identify some of these truths that you just talked about being a great curator? Can you point to a moment in your career or a period in your life where you had a tremendous amount of growth professionally or personally around the curatorial arts and profession?
I don't think there was any one singular moment. I think it was, you know, cumulative experiences. And there might have been, you know, a couple of smaller aha moments in terms of probably, you know, I'll be a little critical here, I won't point out, but, you know, reading a text panel that another curator wrote. Thankfully, I hadn't, but, and I went, what does that mean? You know, and sort of trying to sift through something that was intended for the broader public. And I said, if I'm standing here puzzled in front of a text on the wall, wow, I can just imagine, you know, what the 100 people behind me or in front of me were trying to make of this. And it was, I think, at those moments when you read something, you come across a phrase, you come across sort of a, you know, sort of a twist and turning. And I have absolutely no problem with, you know, an artist statement being poetic or, you know, not being specific. There is a mystery to art that is wonderful. And you know, we want to have that aspect of it. But I also appreciate artists who say, you know, I don't want to write about my art. There it is. Go see it. Go experience it. Go engage with it. See how it makes you feel. See how it makes you react. I can very much appreciate that as well. But I think there is an institutional responsibility anytime a museum, a public museum, in especially, puts text on a wall and says this is for everybody and says here you go. That comes with a tremendous amount of responsibility, and we don't always get it right or perfect. But good museums may acknowledge that and say, well, we'll create layers of interpretation. So here's a tour, here's a text panel, here's something online, here is an app, or here is a website, so that you're peeling back information like layers of an onion, and you hopefully it's tastes better than an onion, unless you really like onions. But you're going through layer by layer to get to the information that you want, and how much of the information, and the complexity of the information. But most importantly, we keep in mind accessibility. We keep in mind how do people come to the museum, how are they welcomed to the museum, and how are they welcomed to what we do as curators in terms of all of this work and research. And sometimes colleagues can miss the forest for the trees if we expect everyone to be familiar with all the nuances and complexities right off the start. Well, that's not the case. And again, that's when we have to step back and say we're educators.
Sure. And there is, I love how you brought up the word accessibility. I think there is a huge responsibility of any institution of the highest caliber in a place like Atlanta, Georgia, to be accessible to those people who are actually walking through the doors and touring the halls and the exhibits. I do find it confounding personally. I'm not in the curatorial arts field at all. But I really do personally enjoy kind of going into depth with my knowledge of the arts and learning about the arts when I'm in a place like the High or any great art museum around the world. You mentioned the balance of accessibility and education and peeling back those layers of knowledge about a particular work of art. Especially when dealing with older works of art, do you find that balance is harder to navigate? And what role do you personally play in ensuring that whatever goes up on the walls, whether that is a text box or something in an audio guide or something in a pamphlet, at what point do you step in to ensure that that is balanced? And is that becoming harder to do today?
I think it is becoming more challenging. There's been sort of the broader lament, and as a historian, an art historian, there has been the broader lament in recognizing that, you know, we are not valuing perhaps or teaching perhaps to some degree history at the same level, and certainly as a broader culture throughout the United States, you know, there's been a lot of, you know, we don't really know historical context. It's not relevant. We're pushing towards science and technology. So, you know, why really should I study 18th century, 19th century history? Why should I know this? And that creates an instant challenge for understanding, again, the context of historic art. Because if you have paintings that are, this painting's talking about the, you know, this election in the 1870s and what it meant to Reconstruction, this and the other, and you use the word Reconstruction, and maybe the person's like, well, Reconstruction, what is that? You know, have no clue. Well, okay, we have to back up. Okay, we're going to have to do a little history lesson of, you know, post-Civil War, et cetera. So it's, in many ways, you know, if you're dealing with contemporary art and say, oh, that happened last week or that happened, you know, last year, and there's commentary on that and there's awareness of it, whereas you're immediately placed in a situation where you have to frame the historical context and really do have to make very, very few, if any, assumptions about what the visitor will bring in terms of historic knowledge to a historic show. again, not to say it's impossible. It's just a matter of navigating what we provide and what we put on the walls, what we put on people's phones and offer in terms of them, you know, engaging with that. Can I look at something that was made in the 18th century and appreciate it as a beautiful object and a wonderful thing? Yeah, absolutely. Am I going to appreciate it more if I can understand why it was made, who made it, you know, for whom, how it was used, et cetera? Well, hopefully so. It becomes something more interesting, just like, you know, anything else. So, again, that's part of the layers of understanding. The first thing is visually seeing it and go, wow. And then the next is, does your mind go to the question of what is that? Who made that? Why did they make it? That is the sort of curiosity that we hope to fuel and we hope to amplify by what we do. But, yes, I do think it's becoming more challenging for historic works when you have to provide a lot of context, and you have to do it in a way that just doesn't seem like they're walking, a visitor's walking into a gallery, getting hit in the face with a history book.
Right, right. And the world as we live in today has become information distillate. We are getting things in very rapid fire,
right,
bite-sized pieces.
Right.
And the average attention span of a millennial or younger,
right,
right, is going down when it comes to going into an art museum in an urban area, especially,
right.
Right? Do you find, as someone who is a custodian of the arts and preserving the legacy of the arts at a place like the High Museum, do you find that it is necessary from a business and preservation perspective to dampen the content and the layers to be able to kind of preserve the experience for the visitor at the expense of the knowledge and the context?
Well, there have long been in the museum field for many, many decades at this point, you know, guidelines for this is how much a visitor will read before they go, no. And dearteningly, you know, the amount of time has gone down. You know, let's go from 20 seconds in front of an object to maybe 11 seconds in front of an object. So, okay, well, here you go. How much of an experience can the person have with that? You know, how likely are they going to be to engage with that? And a text panel on the wall, which, you know, used to be 70 words or less, and then, you know, well, maybe 90 words, and maybe this, that, and the other. And here's the way that you have to write the perfect text panel, and you have to start it with this sentence, etc. And there are a lot of people who just, like, they see text and they'll just pass it by. And so that does place additional onus on the museum and the current world to come up with creative ways. I mean, one of the projects that we have done recently on the digital side, and again, very clearly trying to appeal to the engagement of younger audience and millennial experience and whatnot, it's called Heart Match, and this was just introduced right in time for Valentine's Day. And I really, I can't say enough good things about it. In terms of what we were doing to create what we refer to as sort of the heads up, heads down experience. And we know the heads down experience when you run into somebody in the street and they're looking at their phone and they bump into you. And the heads down experience in the museum is I'm paying attention to my phone. I'm not really looking at the art. I'm doing something else. Or if the museum has created an app or a link to a particular site, that I'm looking at that and I'm not really looking at what's around me, or I'm going to take my selfie and then just keep move on. And the Heart Match is, you know, it's riffing on a sort of popular dating application, you know, swipe left, swipe right,
yep,
images,
yep,
of works of art. And, you know, I like it, I don't like it. And you go through this. And that's, you know, the heads down aspect. Well, the heads up to get you to look at the actual works is once you've just had your sort of initial visual reaction of, oh, that's interesting, that's not interesting, maybe you want a little more information, you can get a little more information. But at the end of it, it creates a map for you, a map that can be shared, it can be uploaded, social media, this, that, and the other, send it to friends. And it's a physical map of where these objects are in the building. So
wow, that's awesome.
That drives you to say, oh, okay, now I really want to see it. And hopefully that curiosity, you know, that carries you on the trail, that you're willing to go up a floor, you know, go across two galleries and find the work and have a chance to see the real thing rather,
right,
than the digital representation on your screen. And I have long had sort of an interest in technology as introduced into the museum world. And actually, my initial college career was a computer science and business double major. And so, you know, I was learning how to do programming and all of this for a couple of years. And then I realized I was more interested in history and art history than anything else. And so I decided to go down that path. But it's led me to this sort of constant awareness of what museums are trying to do with technology, where there are successes and where there have been less than successes, as the case may be. And I do think it's very smart when institutions create things that are drivers to the actual objects and do have that balance of the heads up, heads down.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating. And a couple of questions come to mind immediately following that, but it made me think of an instance just a couple of years ago. I was in Brussels with my girlfriend, and we went to the Belgian Academy of the Arts in Brussels, and one of my favorite paintings of all time is The Death of Moreau by Jacques-Louis David, and I knew that was in there, and I didn't really know what else was in that building. You know, personally, I knew that Moreau was in there, and I was going to go see it, and for someone who knows what they want, it can be relatively straightforward to navigate, bypass, arrive at the thing that you want to see and get the most of your time in the museum. I think it's fascinating that you are allowing the guest to do that digitally on their own and figure out what it is that they want to make their experience. Now, the second question that brings to mind is, are you, I presume, using that data to start tailoring and curating more relevant experiences over time?
Well, we will certainly be using the data to think about. And I think the challenge here is, you know, do you simply use that sort of data as, well, it's a popularity contest of what has the most visual appeal. And maybe, you know, particular objects have visual appeal because they're recognizable or because they have a really cool photograph of them, whatever the object may be, intriguing photograph that prompts it. So I think there are different reasons why there will be sort of the popularity of particular works. I think the greater challenge for us is making the leap to other works. If you like that, maybe you'll like this, and sort of the algorithms behind that. And just as much as, you know, one scratches their head with, you know, seeing television shows that are recommended or books that are recommended and whatnot, you know, you create an algorithm that supposedly gets an idea, oh, well, they like Impressionism, so we're going to throw some more Impressionist works at you. Well, maybe that's logical, but how do you push people beyond their comfort zone in terms of what they know? And for us, as curators, I think that is going to be sort of key in making connections work together in an interesting way. It's something that we actually have physically done recently with our gallery reinstallation by the juxtaposition of objects from different departments. So you'll be in the African galleries, you'll see contemporary works, you'll see photography, you'll see folk art, you'll see. And so there are pieces there that are introduced, so you're not just going to have the singular experience. And I think for the digital application, it's the same way. You know, can we intrigue someone to look beyond that their usual zone of familiarity?
Sure. The reinstallation brings me perfectly kind of segueing into the next piece that I wanted to talk about. And that is, when you came onto the High, came to work for the High Museum June 2017, that was kind of right at the beginning of the High's plans to do this large reinstallation
right.
of works.
Right.
You have been a part of two major reinstallations in the past, if I'm not mistaken.
We'll say two and a half.
Two and a half, okay.
Yes, because one was in planning for 2 years, and then it was shelved for budget and other reasons. But yes, and actually one of the reasons I was interested in coming to the High was not only because of the great work and foundation that was being built in terms of audience engagement and diversity, but really for the opportunity to move immediately into a reinstallation project. Most curators, most museum staff who work with collections in direct way, usually one installation per career is enough. They're challenging projects because they are multi-year projects. But the reality is they're exciting, and it is a moment that doesn't come along all that often. Typically, museums reinstall their collections, and this is just a broad guide, you know, maybe 8 to 12 years, somewhere in that, you know, window every 8 to 12 years, because it is such a substantial undertaking. When I arrived, there had been a lot of discussion, a lot of planning by the curators, by the education staff and others as to what directions the reinstallation might take. And there was certainly a framework of, you know, we're going to have departments, and each of the departments, African art, American art, European, would have their own suite of galleries. And there was an interest in finding a way to bridge thematically between different departments. And there had been a lot of discussion and planning around that. And when I arrived, I asked everybody to sort of take a step back and look at how successful we thought a more purely thematic approach would be. The High had actually done a thematic collection reinstallation after the Olympics were here, and it was prompted in part by the exhibition that was here at the High on the rings. The subsequent reinstallation of the museum's collection was very thematic, you know, love, angst, et cetera. And it allowed you to be cross-departmental, you know, to have African art next to photography, next to American art, next to et cetera, et cetera. But one of the things I think it challenges an institution to do, and there are lots of museums that have experimented with thematic exhibitions around the country and the world, indeed, is you end up losing a sense of what are the great strengths of the institution, right? Because no one says, oh, I remember going to this museum in New York and they really had a lot of things on angst, you know, the angst collection. You don't really think. You think, oh, they have really great American art, or they have great French paintings, or they have this, that, and the other, because we're used to those structures of sort of recognition. Oh, I want to see their Impressionist art. You know, I want to see the Egyptian art. I want to see, et cetera.
And that's pardon me for interrupting, but that's how museums traditionally have laid out their maps, correct?
Right. And so, then you, as a visitor, you might be scratching your head. Well, is this love, or is this, you know, what does this object fit into? You know, what category? So the accessibility part of that, I think that's when that sort of rose to the fore in saying, well, how can we have our cake and eat it to a certain degree in terms of having the flexibility that a thematic installation would give you, but having the accessibility that the standard sort of chronological march through time, everybody knows, you know, 18th century after that is the 19th century after that. Everybody knows nationalities, this country to this country, et cetera. That at least it's, you know, these are distinct things and categorized things. So can we do a little bit of both? And so I came up with this notion for the curators to think about the galleries not as physical spaces and a linear experience. You start in this gallery, you walk through, you go march, next gallery, next gallery, next gallery, as a pure march through time. In some cases, we do have chronology in our American galleries and our European galleries. We still have that because it is accessible. But I wanted them to think about the intellectual concepts around how they organize the exhibition as a honeycomb. And I kept referring to them as modules. And I said a honeycomb because you think about how a honeycomb's connected to adjacent honeycombs. Multiple connectors, right? You can have so many different points of attachments on each of the sort of the facets of the honeycomb. And that's what I wanted, a nonlinear experience where we could put some aspect of African art next to folk art, some aspects of American decorative arts next to folk art, next to this, next to that, contemporary art, et cetera. And that gave us the flexibility that we needed. When we got away from thinking about this is the first object you see, this is the second object you see, and we created a nonlinear experience, which is perfectly appropriate for our buildings because our buildings are very nonlinear. The physical spaces are such where you wander into one gallery and wander into another. The other thing was, even though we were going to have distinct gallery spaces for different works of art, and we were going to have these exchanges in terms of the thematic, you know, modules. We did have some clear priorities in there about how the collection, we wanted the collection's strengths to be perceived. And we have, you know, amazing Department of Folk and self-taught, you know, one of the absolute top in the world in terms of the quality of the collections, the quality of work that we're doing. We have an amazing photography collection. We have amazing historic American decorative arts. Of course, all of our collections have their particular areas of great strength and great significance. And specifically in looking at the folk and self-taught art, we wanted to be able to bridge very clearly an understanding for the visitor that, you know, if a work was made 10 years ago by a self-taught artist, it's every bit equivalent to a work made 10 years ago by an academically trained artist. And so when you go in our modern contemporary galleries, there are objects in there. I mean, there's no designator. We don't go say, oh, this is from this department, that is from that department. But they're works that our specialists, our curator in folk and self-taught have brought to the museum, have acquired from the museum. But they're works of contemporary art.
Right.
Likewise, contemporary design. It's contemporary art. Likewise, contemporary African art. It's contemporary art. So that's why you will walk into our buildings and you will have African, folk and self-taught, and modern and contemporary all on the same floor because they all share collections. And that's the reality. There's contemporary art across all of them. There's historic art in folk art. There's historic art in the African galleries as well. But we wanted to make it clear that there was an equivalency, that there was a happy marriage, that that was a part of that realm, and that they shouldn't be isolated.
Have you been able to track how, what the efficacy of the new design has been with regards to visitor relations to the gallery and the space and movement?
We've been tracking it to a certain degree, and I think the next steps for us in the evaluative process will be to have more detailed information. There are a lot of things we accomplished in the course of less than a year from the hiring of an architect and exhibition designer to the completion of the project this last October and the reopening of the galleries. We accomplished a tremendous amount. I mean, you think of the well over 130,000 square feet of gallery space completely reinstalled. We created physically no new space, but we changed the configuration of certain spaces and we changed the allocation of spaces to recognize the strengths of the collection, the growth of different parts of the collection. In the last decade, you know, over 7,000 objects were acquired of the approximately 17,000 that we have in the collection.
Well,
so much of the growth has occurred just in the last decade. And we want to reflect that growth by putting so many, we'll say new to us, even if the works are old or, or made, you know, within the last year. We want to make sure that what the curators had been acquiring, what they had been establishing as priorities, was seen in this literally new light, as new lighting systems, new electrical systems, all these various upgrades. But it was all very intentional in terms of positioning the high to think ahead of what will our future be. Well, we know photography is a key component of our present day and has been of our history, but it didn't really have the kind of exhibition space that it really a collection of that strength and importance warrants. So we created a space that was five times the size of the previous space. Again, no actual expansion. We just reallocated spaces that were being used in the lower level of our Whelan Pavilion and created a suite of, you know, really beautiful and appropriate spaces for works on paper and photography, which have to be protected from natural light so that they don't fade away. And then created other new spaces, again, sort of reconfiguring things for changing exhibitions, highlighting different parts of our collection. Currently, we have an exhibition, Hand-to-Hand Southern Craft of the 19th Century, that I organized to highlight that important component of our museum's decorative arts collection. And then various niches and pocket galleries that also give us flexibility, small works on paper spaces, small new acquisition highlight spaces, and really giving us the flexibility to do changing exhibitions of different scale, of different focus, and to put greater weight on where our collecting activities have really seen tremendous growth and will continue to see growth.
Yeah. The 2018 reinstallation goals, I found them online and I have them here in front of me, showcase our strengths, reimagine how the collections relate to their gallery spaces, improve wayfinding and flow, mitigate light exposure, and make sure our artworks are properly cared for and display artworks that are relevant to our community. You touched on basically all of these, but on the grand scheme of things, it sounds like the reinstallation has been a tremendous success thus far.
It has. And one of the things that we have been saying here is relative to the reinstallation is, you know, we don't want there to be the perception as of, well, now that we've done it, now we can wait 8 to 12 years and nothing has to happen in the permanent collection galleries. You know, I think that that's the last thing that we want to suggest with this reinstallation. What we're hoping to do with the number of changing spaces and the activity which is going on right now, if you were here in November, after the October reopening, and you saw the galleries. Well, if you come back a month from now, you're going to see different things in those galleries because the rotations of works of art is already taking place. New acquisitions, newly conserved works. We want the reinstallation to be seen as something organic, something that will suggest the continued evolution of those spaces, just as our collection is growing every day. You know, I literally. Half the stack on my desk are, you know, new acquisitions that the curators want to bring in. We have regular meetings to approve gifts and purchases into the collection. And those things will soon see the light of the galleries. And that's what keeps it fresh. It keeps it exciting. You know, gets beyond the, you know, one of the things that people say, well, you know, how much of the collection's out? Well, we have about 1,400 works on view right now.
Wow.
Well,
out of about 1,700 or 17,000.
Out of about 17,000 works. And everybody says, well, where's everything else? And it's, well, no museum. Well, I should say very, very few museums, historic house museums, some of the smaller museums where they have, you know, a collection of 300 objects or 400 objects, they might exhibit everything at once. But the majority of museums, and art museums certainly in the United States, exhibit only a fraction of the works. You know, typically, you know, under 8% of their collection was on view at any one time. And I say, well, it's like anything else where, whether it's a library or what have you, you can't read everything at once. You can't study everything at once. You have the opportunity to experience it, and then you put it away, and then you come back to it at another time. So that's what we do as part of that practice of creating interesting new juxtapositions between different works of art.
Well, congratulations on the reopening of the permanent collection and the reinstallation. That's no small feat at all, and well done to you and your whole team.
Thank you.
I do want to transition real quick just because it was so recent and it was such a big buzz around Atlanta, not only in the arts community but to the city as a whole. And that was the Yayoi Kusama Infinity Mirrors exhibition that ran for a couple of months here at the High, which was, I mean, I don't have the figures in front of me, but I remember receiving an email from the High that was like Kusama by the numbers.
Right.
Just a phenomenal amount of traffic.
Right. Over 140,000 visitors.
Yes. That's incredible. Yes, yeah. That's incredible. I just wanted to touch briefly on what, you know, that the experience of setting that exhibition up, something of that scale. And just, you know, talk about how it led to, you know, being such a large success, at least, you know, seemingly the perception is that it was a huge success for the High Museum.
No, absolutely. No, it's a tremendous success, and it was really a logical part of the museum's program. In terms of our modern and contemporary program, Kusama is an internationally acclaimed artist whose work really from the 1960s to the present day has received attention by so many institutions, so many museums, and including collectors and staff here in Atlanta in terms of recognizing her work and the importance of the work. So why wouldn't we if we had the opportunity to do so? And fortunately, we did. You know, it was an exhibition organized by the Hirshhorn in Washington, D.C., and had a very successful tour. We just happened, it was a matter of good timing and good connections with our colleagues, as so many touring exhibitions are in terms of you know, what is your schedule like? Is it available? You know, what are the interests? And so we were able to put our interest forward in a very strong way, and our timing and all of those things very fortunately for us fell into place that we were able to host the exhibition as one of the venues, and indeed the last venue for the tour. And yes, it was a tremendous success, and one which benefited by the fact that our peer institutions that had hosted the exhibition shared a lot of great information about ticketing and traffic flow and things that we were encountering, if not for the first time, probably for the first time on that scale and that level of complexity in terms of online ticket sales and things of that nature. But was a really, you know, thank you for the comments, and we've received a lot of amazing positive feedback from all the visitors that were able to experience the Kusama exhibition, and I think, you know, in particular the appeal, the sort of multi-sensory environmental of the rooms themselves, the Infinity rooms themselves, has added sort of a layer of attention, you know, and certainly help fuel the frenzy around the Kusama tour. But it's ultimately great work, and everyone says, "Oh, well, you know, which room is your favorite, Kevin Yenny?" And it's like, "Oh, I don't like to get into favorites when it comes to works of art. It's like naming your favorite child." And I said, interesting enough, it for me, here's one case where I'll volunteer it. You know, I was entranced by her early paintings in the 1950s, sort of leading up to the dot paintings of the late 50s and into the 60s, because I thought they had a really, you know, beautiful, quiet quality to them, amazing abstraction and whatnot. And you know, those were works that I think I was hoping more people would stop and sort of engage with and look, because these are really great. And every opportunity that I had in the galleries, I don't miss those. Go take a look at that wall over there, because it's those sorts of surprises. You know, everyone knew that the Infinity Rooms were a part of the experience, but we wanted to encourage people to look at the sculpture, look at the paintings, look at everything, and again, understand her wider career as well.
And were those paintings the kind of first set of paintings on the wall when you walk into the...
No, they were actually all the way around. You sort of like looped around, was just beyond the second Infinity Room, and then before the third one, there was one long wall that had the works from the 1950s.
Okay, good. Wide-ranging. I hadn't really had a chance to explore Kusama's work much before that exhibit. Just various aspects of very poppy art, also a lot of phallic, very kind of erotic art, and just... Fascinating, but how long did that exhibit or exhibition take to set up? I mean, just logistically, it seems like there was a lot of work put into that.
The downtime for exhibitions, you know, typically is around a sort of a 3-week window. We try to do these things both as safely and as quickly as possible. The Kusama had a layer of complexity because of the room construction. But still, we were able to do it very efficiently because, you know, a lot of those elements were prepared. We had advanced time in terms of wall construction, that sort of thing. So it's we try to keep our downtime to an absolute minimum between exhibitions, but the physical construction, of course, just added more time, a little more complexity to that.
Sure. Speaking of exhibitions, you have one coming up here at the High, the Phillips Collection.
Mm-hmm.
It's been very well publicized, and I'm personally very much so looking forward to the opening of that next week.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit on that? I mean, this is the time to plug in and talk about it and tell us all about. I mean, I've read sort of the synopsis of what the collection involves, but I would like to kind of hand it off to you to tell us about it.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's Phillips Collection is based in Washington, D.C., in what was Duncan Phillips' home. And it's a very, very personal collection of modern art. And in fact, when it was established as a museum in 1921, was America's first museum of modern art, even before the museum Museum of Modern Art existed years before that was created in New York. And so what you get with the Phillips Collection, if you would visit when these paintings are not on tour and they were actually part of their collection installation, is you would get a particular snapshot of Duncan Phillips, the collector, and what his preferences were and were not in terms of what he was buying in the early 20th century as modern art. And to be sure, there are a lot of the names that will be widely recognizable to visitors in the collection. And then a couple of pieces, perhaps, you know, either less recognizable or sort of questions of, you know, why are they amidst all of these others? Well, the exhibition, we're very fortunate to be one of currently only three venues that have hosted the exhibition, Fort Worth and Tokyo, and now here in Atlanta. And the Phillips Collection had been undergoing some renovations, which has allowed a number of these works to travel. So it was better that they're on the road, getting exposure in various other museums, and then put into storage. So the Phillips has shared these works with us and with Atlanta as part of this exhibition. So there are around 70 works included in the show, and about six of them are sculpture and the rest are paintings. And the earliest work in the exhibition is a painting by Chardin, but the from the 18th century. But the bulk of the exhibition, it really begins sort of in the first, second quarter of the 19th century and carries us all the way through the 1950s. And it's really exciting in terms of the focus of the collection in the latter half of the 19th century and early 20th century. So, you know, if you want to see Picasso, Matisse, you want to see Degas, you want to see Van Gogh, you want to see, you know, Corot, you want to see Manet. Well, we'll come. Daumier, they're all represented in the collection with really astounding works. And so I think if you love 19th century art, you like Impressionist art, you like Post-Impressionist, you want to see, you know, early modern art, Kandinsky and Picasso and Matisse and Braque and others, well, come see the Phillips Collection when it opens in the following week. So it's very exciting for it.
Do people just come and get tickets at the front box office?
You will be with regular museum admission. It's part of the experience. So not have to. It will not be a Kusama online separate ticketed event. One does not have to go through that at all. But we're very happy to be able to provide this as part of the regular museum experience. And I think in terms of why we decided to bring the Phillips Collection here, we actually have a moment that we wanted to step back and look at historic European art. We have a new curator of European art, Claudia Einecke, who has come to us from the Getty this last year, taking on that position. And this will be her first major exhibition project that she has shepherded through our galleries in terms of the installation while she is working on some of her own projects. So it's, in many ways, it's a re-debut of the museum's program for European art.
Well, I'm very excited about it personally, and I know many of my friends and family are, and I can't wait for it. So congratulations.
Great.
And I'm excited
you.
For it to open up. Kind of final line of questioning here about the people around Atlanta and in the greater kind of Southeast region who may want to visit the High, maybe haven't had much exposure to a museum of art or the High Museum at all. What is some of your kind of practical, tactical advice for somebody engaging with the High Museum for the first time to get the most out of their experience, whether that is, you know, going through some of the permanent collection or the Phillips Collection or the main gallery, or otherwise through events? Like, I know you guys have First Fridays
right.
at the High, and there's a big focus on art and you at the High.
Right, so, absolutely.
I mean, what is some advice that you have?
Certainly First Fridays are a great time. Second Sundays, free admission. We have, we have thousands of participants in our Second Sundays program. So it's a great time if, you know, you're unable to pay admission, or you simply just want to come and enjoy all of the experiences that we offer on Second Sundays, you know, that's a great time to come as well. I think, you know, for those, as you said, you know, who may not have experienced the high before, or may not be used to the museum going experience, I think the one thing that we want to underscore is we don't want the museum to be an intimidating experience in any way, shape, or form. Certainly we have an obligation to protect works of art in our care, again, as curators and as stewards of the collections and that we have here. But come to the museum, enjoy it, experience it, make it a date. Have a coffee, have a cocktail, just experience it. Bring your kids. Come as a couple, however you would like to do it, and make the museum part of your life, and make it an enjoyable, relaxing, wonderful, energizing experience. That is what we want to ask. We don't want there to be barriers to the experience of engaging with works of art. We are working hard to peel away as many of those barriers as we can. We're working very hard to bring the community into what is their museum. We talk about it as our museum, and we don't mean that ours in terms of the staff and the trustees. We mean it ours in terms of our entire visitorship. So we want you to realize you're already part of the family.
Well, thank you. And I am looking forward to continuing my kind of personal interaction with the High as a lifelong Atlantan and someone who's always kind of cherished the High being in the city as, again, just like a huge beacon for arts in our region and throughout the nation and worldwide. And very much so thankful for people like yourself, Kevin, who continue to just pour so much of yourself into the arts and help make just the art ecosystem that we live in here in Atlanta that much better.
Well, thank you. And, you know, I can't do it without the great team that we have here. It truly is a community effort. It's not only the staff here, it's all the patrons that make it possible and every single visitor that comes as well. So it is truly a joint effort.
Well, Kevin Tucker, Chief Curator of the High Museum of Art, thank you so much for taking some time out of your day to sit down with me and let me pick your brain with my random line of questioning. Pleasure to meet you. Pleasure to talk to you. Congratulations on the reinstallation, and congratulations and best of luck on the Phillips Collection opening up.
Great. Thank you so very much.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Show ATL Podcast, the podcast where we seek to find and highlight Atlanta creatives and creators and tell the stories of the people and organizations making amazing things in our city. I am your host, Parsa Benamory. Our show today was produced by Mr. Coleman Erkins with help from myself and Corrigan Nolan. Our music is produced by Relax with Alex. Want to thank all of the guests who come onto this program and tell their amazing stories with us and share with us, as well as to our wonderful listeners who continue to support us week in and week out. If you love this episode, if you love this show as a whole, if you like Show ATL and consider it something that you listen to frequently, please consider giving us a 5-star rating or a nice review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever else you use to listen to your podcasts. Please consider supporting us if you'd care to. Again, we're a small team working to put together this show for you every week. And we have a Patreon page, www.patreon.com/showATL. You can give a one-time donation or a recurring donation. All funds will be used to make this show better and better and better for you. So we would greatly appreciate that. Thank you again for listening. Thank you again for supporting us. Thank you again for being a part of the conversation that we continue to have day in and day out to make our city a better place, a more creative place. We will catch you next time. Thank you. Goodbye. Today's episode is brought to you by Old Fourth Ward Light Co. Based out of Atlanta, Old Fourth Ward Light Co. leverages unique design and artistry blended with unusual everyday items to create really unique and cool-looking lamps. If you go to www.oldfourthwardlight.com and click on the shop button, you'll be able to see their full range of products. And if you enter the coupon code SHOWATL at checkout, you can get 10% off any order. Thanks.